Hello, you're listening to The West Wing Weekly. I'm Joshua Molina.
And I'm Hrishikesh Hirway. And today we're talking about episode 14 from season 7. It's called 2 Weeks Out.
That's right. It was directed by Happy Face or Sad Face, Laura Innes. And it was written by Lawrence O'Donnell. It first aired on March 19th, 2006.
In this episode, the election looms closer, and the two candidates keep crossing the country and each other's paths.
Zugma!
Hey.
It's been a long time.
It has been.
Oh, God, I've been waiting for this moment. Maybe we'll come full circle, and we'll start doing more Zugma, and we'll talk about octopuses again as the show, as the podcast winds up.
Octopus Flimple. The Santos campaign is trying to capitalize on its momentum by making a big bet on California. But unbeknownst to them, Senator Vinnick has his own California strategy, one his own team disagrees with. We're getting down to the wire here, and it's still anyone's ballgame.
Yeah, that's the show.
I wanted to just note that Alan Alda won the Emmy for Best Supporting Actor for this season, based in part on his performance in this episode.
Oh, how about that? Mm-hmm. He's good, as always.
He is.
Did you like how, as always, they flash the title of the episode, and then I think they flash Chicago Convention Center, and then they flash 14 days before election, just in case you didn't know how 2 weeks broke down into days.
Then they flashed a map of the country with a star on Chicago.
Yeah. I felt a little offended. I felt my intelligence had been questioned with their choice of chyrons.
Plus, they already picked this as episode 14.
Ha! Just to really emphasize, 14 days before election.
Mm-hmm.
The presidential election.
Of America. Okay, so this episode begins with Senator Vinnick kind of going through the ringer, the hand ringer.
Ooh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I'm just responding to there are some shots. I a little bit felt like the beginning of a medical thriller because there's some very graphic. His hand is taking a pounding. It really looks bad. It was like the beginning of Outbreak or something. And the way it was shot and in tight and close. And I like what Laura Innes did with the overhead shots of his glad handing the crowd and
or sad handing in this case.
Indeed. And it looked to me like it could be about how he was spreading some sort of lethal bacterium. It felt like Outbreak to me.
I have a newfound appreciation for this part of the episode because of our own event in Washington, D.C. for two reasons.
Mm.
One, that was a big show for us. We had over 2,000 people there and we stayed and tried to talk to as many of them as possible. And I have never shaken that many hands in one night. And sure enough, by the end of the night, my hand hurt a lot.
It's real.
Not only that, while we were there in D.C., I got a pamphlet on the dangers of grip and grin from a fellow named Abraham Saffer from the American Occupational Therapy Association.
Oh, I forgot about that. I remember
Yeah.
handing it over.
He gave it to us in preparation for this episode. We were still at the end of season 6, so we had a little ways to go, but it's been great. And I'm going to put a link to a PDF of the pamphlet that he gave me. The title is Grip and Grin. The subtitle is Tips from Occupational Therapists About Surviving Handshaking on the Campaign Trail. This is from the American Occupational Therapy Association. And here are some excerpts from this pamphlet, which you can read in its entirety when you go to our website. It says, the announcement speech is made and the petitions are filed. The campaign rally and the county fair event are scheduled. In the months ahead, you will be shaking hands with countless future constituents. At the close of a long day, you may find yourself with pain and stiffness in your hands, arms, neck, and back. My hands, my arms, my neck. Sorry. Just went into a Kia there. My neck, my back. Okay, well, we'll save that one for HBO Max.
I sing that actually after I go to IKEA. And I've assembled a particularly difficult chest of drawers.
That's pretty good. Okay, back to the pamphlet here. Let's see. Stiffness in your hands, arms, neck, back, dreading that crush. I mean, they're really setting up this episode because they say, dreading that crushing grip from an overenthusiastic well-wisher.
Mm.
Really, as good of an evocation of the football player who destroys Vinnick's hand at the end of the cold open as what you could hope for.
Yes. I was hoping, though, since Santos appears so soon after Vinnick leaves, Santos appears on the same stage. I was hoping they'd have the same exact moment where they shook hands and he was like, ow, ow. Either that or Santos would crush the other guy.
That's what I was thinking. In just a, you know, sign of his youth and vitality, the football player would start screaming.
Yeah.
Anyway, there are lots of great tips in this pamphlet about exercising not just your hands, but really your whole body, because your back and your neck are, as they say in this pamphlet, important allies. And you need to make sure you protect and save them for the heavy burdens of office. It's a great pamphlet. I mean, it's informational and delightful at the same time.
Fantastic. I don't know if, not to insult our listeners and our live event audiences, but every time we do a meet and greet afterwards, I go back to my hotel and I fill a bathtub with Purell and I immerse my entire body up to the neck.
Not me. Give me them germs.
Well, that's probably why your immune system is better than mine. I can't go outside anymore.
It's true. We want to give a shout out to Josh's new recording studio, The Bubble.
It's in a bubble. Yeah, that's right.
So thanks again to Abraham for giving us that pamphlet. Really looks like something that Vinnick could have used. Although some of the tips I have to say would not work for the very reasons that are addressed in this episode. You know, one of the final tips they say is, if necessary, wear a splint or a brace from a drugstore on your hand or wrist to warn off aggressive glad-handers.
No cash, Senator.
I can't look like an old man falling apart on the campaign trail.
And he's got a crowd.
Actually, my favorite tip in this whole thing is this one. Hold something that cannot be put down easily in order to keep people from shaking your bad hand.
Right. That's very clever.
What is that? A baby?
I like that.
A really good book.
I literally can't put it down.
All right. I have some other high-level thoughts about this episode before we get into the minutia. There are some interesting guest stars who appear in this episode. I wanted to know if you caught, at the very beginning of the episode,
Santos aide number two.
Yeah, Danny Pudi from
Danny
Community.
Danny Pudi. I had that, wait a minute, was that? And I hit my go back 10 seconds button, or maybe it's 30 seconds on Netflix. And I was like, yeah, I was right.
He's the guy who says to Josh,
guest list for the Cleveland event.
Yeah, right there.
Yep. And you could see in that moment the potential of his comic future.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's always funny. I love to see kind of a little just bit part and you go, okay, so he wasn't who he is now then.
Yeah.
He was just starting out.
Mm-hmm. The Vinnick staffer, Annie, who's maybe Vinnick's body person, like Vinnick's Charlie.
Yes.
It turns out she played Liza in the movie Love, Liza. I don't know if you saw that, but it stars Philip Seymour Hoffman. It was written by his brother, Gordy Hoffman.
Oh, wow.
And it holds a special place in my heart because I saw it early when I first moved to LA way back in 2002. I went to a Q&A for the movie at the Arclight, and it was great. Gordy Hoffman was there, as was the director, Todd Luiso, who I had seen, you know, who was in High Fidelity. It was a very exciting way to start my time in LA.
Sure. That's cool.
And she was the title character. She was Liza in Love, Liza. Okay, and then the third character I wanted to note is the reporter, who we find out by the end is named Ellen.
Mm.
Did you clock that character?
No.
Ellen is the one who, we see her a bit at the beginning, and then she's one of the people covering Vinnick.
So you no longer think regulation of nuclear power plants is burdensome?
No.
Do you regret saying it was?
I wouldn't write that letter today.
Do you regret it?
That was 25
And when he eventually does his press conference, you know, he wears everybody down. Ellen's one of the last few, and even she doesn't have, she kind of is grilling him, but even by the end, she doesn't have any more questions for him. And Ellen is played by Colette O'Connell, who, it turns out, had already been in the West Wing playing the same character, playing this reporter, Ellen, from Boston Globe. She was in another Lawrence O'Donnell episode, Message of the Week. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. You know, Lawrence has this specific character who he's included in two of these episodes. And I thought, oh, maybe he wrote this role for this actor. And then I checked, and it turns out that she was also in an episode of Lawrence's show, Mr. Sterling.
Huh. This is, you're like the Ashley Feinberg of West Wing. You're getting to the bottom of, much as she reverse engineered and figured out that Pierre Delecto was Senator Romney's alias. If you've done some research. Did anywhere in your research, did you discover why Lawrence O'Donnell didn't point out to her that it's pronounced nuclear? because I felt that as a journalist, she ought to have known that.
Yeah. I did discover that. I do think that there is some kind of name-based nepotism here going on, a conspiracy.
It's pronounced nepotism, I think.
Where Lawrence is just, you know, looking out for other O-blank Onnells in the world.
I see.
Colette O'Connell here. And then, you know, famously, Lawrence always casting Michael O'Monnell, Jerry O'Donnell.
Yeah. And also in a lot of his scripts, there's Patty O'Furniture. I've noticed.
You're ignoring my joke and just going for your own
jokes. Oh, sorry. Did I steamroll over your joke?
No, it's
I was
fine,
excited.
It's fine.
I had one loaded up. I'm going to real tunnel vision when I've got a real zinger like that ready to go.
Okay, let's talk about the actual episode. It turns out there's a lot of crossover at events in these last couple of weeks. We see them not only in Chicago here at the beginning, both doing the same event, but then later they're both at the same venue in Philadelphia.
Right, right. Well, we got to get them into the same room for the suitcase gag.
What did you think about the suitcase gag?
Well, I thought it was interesting. I like ethical dilemmas. I thought there was also interesting this idea of plausible deniability. I've been on a weird binge of the TV series Succession.
Mm-hmm.
There is, I thought, a sort of kind of similar storyline in the first season where one of the characters who works for this giant organization, I guess the whole thing is kind of a take on the Murdoch family.
Right, Fox
media News. Media conglomerate. Yeah, Fox News. And the whole media company. And he finds out some very unsavory things about one section of their empire, the cruise lines. And there's just a lot of maneuvering about who knows what and maybe don't tell me. And once you do know, you're infected and you're part of the problem. And if you don't act on it, you're implicated. And I just thought it was interesting because Vinnick, very early in the sort of conversation about the suitcase, mentions plausible deniability. And I thought one way this really might have gone in a political, in a real political presidential campaign, is for Bruno to have acted without even bringing it up to the candidate.
Yeah.
And maybe that's the most plausible way it would have happened. So, and knowing Bruno, I think he might have done that because he's smart enough to know that if he brings it up, that maybe they're not going to go with this, what he feels is a slam dunk win. You know, I can win the presidential election here with what I've got, or so he believes. And I think maybe the most plausible response from Bruno would have been to go ahead and leak it or do whatever he was going to do with it without even mentioning it to Vinnick. Once he has, we now have, you know, Vinnick's sense of propriety and what's right. And as it plays out, he eventually does, you know, return the case to Santos. I just thought it was interesting, and I wonder whether it would have realistically played out this way, or they would have insulated the candidate from the whole situation.
Great. I like the plausible deniability linchpin of the whole thing a lot, because for me, that's what's critical about Bruno's sense of urgency about this. I think that if Bruno felt like this was sort of a dirty move, if he thought that this was actually a cheap shot, then he would not have brought it to Vinnick. He might not have used it at all, or he might have done, like you said, he would have thought about the plausible deniability needed for the candidate and just done it in secret. Maybe, right? It would be his own ethical dilemma to ponder.
Right.
The fact that he brings it to his candidate and basically endangers the guy knowingly, because Vinnick even says,
"A briefcase can kill us.
It's got a sort of a journal in there.
I said, don't tell
it's
me.
It's a day planner."
And Bruno keeps pressing him on it. As I was watching it, I was like, why would Bruno do this? Why would he be like openly defying this desire for plausible deniability? This very like understandable one. And I think it's because he really believes what he's saying. He's like,
you know, Santos never got the vetting a front runner gets. He wasn't supposed to get the nomination. The press gave him a free ride in the primaries. Until now, he's been running way behind you. So the press still hasn't done their digging on him, but they will now. So, really doesn't matter what you do with that briefcase. It's going to come out. If it comes out when Santos is in the White House, I don't know what happens. All hell's going to break loose.
I really think that Bruno thinks that he is doing the right thing, and this is not in any kind of way a political hit job in his mind.
I'm not sure I agree with you. I think one of the great aspects of this storyline is that I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Is that I sort of kind of, you know, I do think it's possible that he sincerely feels that way. And I also think it's possible he's kind of full of shit. And he's trying to convince the candidate, maybe even himself, that really what he's looking out for is the electorate. And, you know, we can't let this guy get into office and got what this happens, comes out later, what's going to happen. And I'm not quite sure. And that's, I think, one of the nice things about the writing, directing, and the performance from Ron Silver is I'm not quite sure whether he means it or not. I'm not even sure he knows.
Yeah. And that might be what we're supposed to take from it. But my feeling was, because he's endangering his own candidate's plausible deniability, which is something that an operative wouldn't normally do, I don't think, it must only be because he thinks that this is right.
Except that there's maybe a little bit of CYA, and he's covering himself by, you know, spiraling, spinning the problem upwards higher than his pay grade. So now if things fall apart and it looks bad and there's trouble or maybe even legal issues, it's like, well, hey, he knew.
You know,
I just passed on the information and then he took it from there. So there may be an aspect of that. It's one of the things I like about the situation in Succession where the guy finds out this bad information, starts kind of deciding who's expendable and onto whom he'll try to shunt the issue.
I think one of the things that complicates it too is the history and dynamic between these two characters. You know, Bruno came on having historically done Democratic races and is in as an outsider. You know, this is a completely different situation than, say, if it were Josh and President Bartlett or something like that, where you absolutely know Josh would have just done it and protected the president from it. Like, the protection of the president would have been paramount.
Yeah, I suspect you're right. Although one of the interesting aspects of this whole thing too also is the initial sweep of the bag that Bruno did. I mean, to the point of opening up his checkbook and looking through it. I mean, it's like, you know, that's where it's really dicey. It's not like this information didn't hit him over the head. He opened up a briefcase, he realized what it was, and then he forensically examined everything in that briefcase.
Yeah, he looked for dirt.
Yeah, absolutely.
He was specifically looking for dirt.
For sure. Yeah, with a trained eye, and he found it. Which also, I have to say, made me wonder, once you'd seen the whole episode, did you take Matt Santos's original concern about the briefcase to be in part because of the checkbook that was in there? I couldn't tell whether it was just normal concern about, hey, you lost my stuff. I mean, there's private stuff. I've got a campaign going out. Or did you believe he had the checkbook in mind? Like, ugh.
I didn't take it that he was thinking of the checkbook specifically. It was more just, that's all my personal stuff.
Okay, because I thought maybe there was an aspect of that. And I kept thinking, like, maybe he shouldn't have written down, you know, maybe he shouldn't have logged the checks so accurately. And maybe he should have pretended that money was going for gum or something.
Yeah. I think there's probably a level of naivete to Matt Santos that didn't ever imagine that this kind of information would be something that you have to worry about some political opponent getting their hands on. And he's just thinking, all my stuff is in there.
Right. Well, I guess the thought was this. If he has a dedicated separate checking account, he knows there's something to hide.
Right, yeah.
And given that, maybe he shouldn't have logged the information so accurately. Like, why write the woman's name in who can then be Googled and found? And by the way, I also think it's interesting that in the ultimate conversation between Vinnick and Santos, there is at least a germ of a doubt as to whether he's telling the truth, that it's his brother's.
Absolutely there is.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of brilliant because I think maybe I had read a description of the episode. I don't usually do this, but I think I'd come across a description of the episode before, synopsis, or I don't know. I read something that kind of gave away, like, oh, that's this storyline, which I had forgotten about. And whoever wrote this synopsis was completely convinced by him. So I thought it was going to play out that way. And then when I
see what you're saying. You're saying there's a doubt even for you.
Oh, yeah.
That there's doubt in the world about this. That's interesting.
Clearly, Vinnick wonders.
Yes.
And I also wondered, and maybe it's 1% to 99% belief and 1% question, but it left me enough of a doubt. The fact that Vinnick says, look, it doesn't matter what I believe, I found interesting as a viewer. I thought, well, yeah. I mean, again, I also don't like when, you know, you're a hero or you're not a hero. And if you're a hero, you got to believe everything the heroes say because they're West Wing heroes. So, you know, although it still has its effect on me and I'm inclined to believe Santos when he says something like that. But I liked that I walked away from that scene also thinking, or maybe he does have a love child.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I think is so brilliant about this is that it actually doesn't matter. Like the actual facts of it don't matter. And Vinnick's doubt in that moment underscores that. Like that's what's telling us that these are two guys, sure, they're not friends, but I think they have some sense of the other's integrity. And even in a moment like that, when one tells the other, this is what the truth is, he still doesn't necessarily believe him. And it made me think of an exchange from way back in episode 3 of The West Wing, when Sam says to CJ about Lori.
CJ.
I see.
This is ridiculous.
You're there to help her see the error of her ways.
I'm there because I like her. I'm there because it's there that I'd be if this were alcohol or drugs. I'm not sleeping with her. This isn't tawdry.
I don't care what it is. I care what it looks like.
And I care what it is. And I think it's high time we all spend a little less time looking good and a little more time
being good.
Yes.
Yeah, I've heard that one.
You know, she's not impressed by the moral high ground that he's trying to take. And that just echoed through here because it really doesn't matter what the truth is in terms of the ramifications for the election.
Well, unless you accept the argument that you did accept from Bruno, if you believe that he thinks the public has a right to know, it's kind of, to me, it then does matter whether he's just doing something of deep integrity and covering for the needs of a child that his brother fathered out of wedlock and has abandoned, or if he's doing something that maybe is compromising for a president to have as a secret. I mean, I think it does matter in that sense if you accept the argument like the public has a right to know about this kind of thing.
Well, I mean, it doesn't matter in that it's always going to be bad for Santos regardless of what the truth is.
Oh, I see. You're just saying in a negative point of view.
I'm saying, yeah, he if this gets out, it's going to hurt him regardless of what the truth is. Because there are going to be some people, even if they know what, even if he says, hey, this is the truth, blah, 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 take a DNA test, all that stuff, whatever definitive truthiness that you could try and pull from this situation, it's still going to hurt him. Either it's going to hurt him a ton or it's going to hurt him some.
Yes, I suspect you're right. Because this also takes place in another time and in a fictional universe where the president's behavior matters at all.
Exactly, right, right.
Because I of course, had my Trump I moments during this, where somebody found a checkbook and the president had paid off porn stars with whom he was having adulterous affairs secretly and perhaps illegally. And yep. The populace doesn't care.
Yeah. But so I have a feeling about this suitcase plot. While it is interesting, everything, it is, in some ways, I almost didn't need it in this episode. There was a lot already going on, and I found the whole storyline about, you know, the strategy and, like, whether it's a chess match or a football game, just the sort of trying to read the other side's plays and go where they're not going to go and make the most use out of your resources, whether it's money or airtime or the story. I found all that stuff so fascinating that in some ways this plot line, which is a little bit more maybe seedy, maybe a little bit more succession-y, you know, like I almost
contrived.
I almost didn't need it. Like I was like, this feels like it could be from a different show. And while I think they dealt with it well and took it into a place, you know, of moral quandary that's interesting, in some ways, it felt like I was getting 125% of an episode within one.
That's a fair take.
There was enough tension in the plot about just chasing each other around the country.
True. That's another interesting aspect of the episode where Josh, there's almost like a Cyrano de Bergerac thing going on with Toby and Josh. It's like a Cyrano, and I think Christian is the person in whose mouth he puts words in Cyrano, where suddenly Josh is just taking Toby's phone calls and putting his ideas into play without crediting him. And maybe you don't want to mention that you're talking to Toby Ziegler at this moment in American politics, but it's interesting. It's almost like Toby's calling the shots from wherever it is he's sitting next to the phone.
I think it's great that Toby has a code name, Bob.
Bob.
And then later, Josh refers to him just as...
usual suspects, party people, experienced campaign types, and...
I love that Toby has a voice in this. I mean, I think it's what Josh has always wanted and has never gotten until this moment, you know, like actually having... You know, we see the fruits of the labor of him going back to Toby's apartment that time, that Toby has come around, you know, even from within his house arrest and is giving him pointers the way that I think Josh probably felt like it should have been, you know, the two of them working on this together.
Right. He's finally got a genuine phone a friend option.
Yeah. It's one person who he spent so much time with. You know, everybody else there is either a newcomer or somebody who worked below him. Toby's the first person who was, you know, really his equal. I mean, he's got Leo there, but we don't see Leo in this episode. But, you know, just the fights that they had had, the resentment that they'd expressed to one another, Toby, you know, to Josh for leaving the Bartlett White House, and Josh to Toby for not being a better friend and cheerleader for his candidate. It's really nice to see the two of them coming together.
I agree. Speaking of Santos and Leo, I did find it titillating that Bruno had found in the journal that Santos sort of griped about how bad Leo is at campaigning.
Yeah. He also apparently had some not nice things to say about Russell, which isn't that surprising.
That's right.
I don't know how damaging that would really be. You know what was not titillating?
What's that?
The absolute lack of follow-up on Josh and Donna's kiss in this episode.
Indeed. That's right.
What happened?
Nothing.
Yeah.
Hmm. Donna's not in this episode, is she?
Mm-mm.
Not at all.
Nope. So, you know, just press pause on that, I guess.
Mm-hmm. What say we take a quick break and come back later? And now, back to the show.
You know what made me laugh? The mentions of the worst case scenario with the briefcase.
Worst case, it got slipped into checked baggage, and we'll have it to you by the time you get back to your room.
And then Bram repeats it to the candidate.
Bram says it to Santos, and I was just thinking, man, you guys do not have my kind of imagination when it comes to worst case scenarios. I mean, what actually happens is certainly a far worse scenario.
Indeed.
I have a special gift when it comes to imagining worst case scenarios, and these guys don't have it.
There's a whole book dedicated, I think it's called The Worst Case Scenario Handbook, and I enjoy it. It's about, you know, being prepared for falling into a shark tank and things like that. And I've read it in its entirety in my parents' bathroom.
I mean, I think that pretty much sums it up for me. I'm like, at any point, one might end up falling into a shark tank. Any scenario, I will connect the dots to how it leads to death.
Interesting. We're built similarly in that sense. Although I will say, having that sort of tilt to your personality and to your thought process also leads to being grateful. Like, things seem much better when you are so cognizant of how incredibly horrible they could be.
Yeah, yeah. There's a great book called Kiss and Tell. Did you ever read that book?
That sounds familiar. What is that book?
It's a book by Alain de Botton, if I'm saying his name correctly. He's talking about this woman's ex and how he was the kind of person who you'd want to have around in case a plane crashed on an island or something like that, you know? But then later he qualifies that by saying, which is to say, a person with absolutely no imagination. Okay, so Bram is not thinking about all of the possible scenarios, but I was thinking, you know, who Bram has encountered before is Santos's brother, Jorge Santos. We've actually met him before.
Yes, I feel like he came to an event or showed up late, or there was something about the car being in the way. Or
he wanted to invite some like business contacts that he had.
Right.
I think it's actually a great setup for this. We see his brother as he seems like kind of a skeezy guy.
Yes.
Listen, I invited over a couple of business associates for drinks and a photo. Think we can get it past your stormtroopers?
Sure.
I'll see what I can do.
And then Bram has to figure out like clearing those guys and getting them into the house when they're in Texas.
Yeah, that's right. I did remember the impression that his brother had made.
Yeah, in just a few lines.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to say one thing about the Vinnick hand injury. One more thing, rather. When he has the cast on after he gets it from the doctor, I really liked how much trouble he has opening the USA Today copy that he has in his cabin.
he opens it kind of Johnny Carson style when he used to do Karnak, and he used to open the envelope and blow into it.
Exactly. Yeah, he can't fully do it with his hands, so he has to blow the pages open. That's great.
I love that. He also has a bad interaction with a packet of sugar, trying to open it with one hand.
So outside of the briefcase, I think really the central question in this episode is this one that Vinnick poses.
When is old news going to be old news?
In terms of the nuclear power plant disaster at San Andreo, he is just getting dogged by the quote that he said in the debate where he said nuclear power is completely safe. And he thinks that with Kazakhstan and all the other things that are going on, the press should move on. But it's like unwanted ballast dragging down his campaign, keeping them from getting any kind of forward momentum again. Meanwhile, they see Santos is, you know, tied in many of the polls, and some states that should have never been in play are suddenly in play. And the two sides kind of come to the same conclusion through different routes, which is that California is going to be key to the election, and for different reasons. Because if Santos can win California, where suddenly Vinnick is vulnerable because the nuclear power plant was in California, then there's going to be headline after headline about how Santos is going to steal Vinnick's own home state. And that kind of press and that kind of story will do more for the campaign than any kind of ad buy that they might make, you know, when they're trying to figure out how to win California, and rather than spend the money, if they can go there and campaign and really win it, like really put a concerted effort in it, then that could really tip the whole election.
Yes.
And on the other side, the Vinnick campaign realizes that they've got a similar kind of one state focus on California because they're reading the same tea leaves. If they let Santos take the state, then that's really going to be it.
A Republican can win the presidency without California.
And a Democrat can't. This isn't some sentimental home state thing. This is about winning.
Really, he's saying, like, if I can hold it, Santos just can't win. There's no path to victory.
Right. It's not going to happen for him.
Yeah.
There's mention in one of these conversations about potentially adopting a Southern strategy, but it's said sort of unironically, without sort of acknowledging the history of the Southern strategy and Nixon's pivot to sort of courting racism.
Racists, yeah.
It's weird. It kind of blew by me, and I had to go back and listen to it again. I thought it was kind of a weird moment where they're just talking about going and, you know, concentrating on Southern states and trying to campaign there and put more of the focus there. But it sort of kind of runs by, and the import and the resonance of saying the Southern strategy is kind of not really acknowledged.
Yeah, exactly. Southern strategy, those two words together really ought to be italicized or capitalized or somehow, you know, rendered in a way that as specific as it historically ought to be. You can't just toss them around and saying, like, well, that's our strategy for the South.
Yeah, no, yeah, exactly. Whoa, hang on a second. A little historical context.
Yeah, it's like saying, finally, I think this could be the solution. I think this is the final solution.
Right. Yes, exactly. Which phrase, by the way, our dear president nearly tweeted recently, because he said something about something, I think it was vis-a-vis Ukraine, vis-a-vis Syria, saying that something about an ultimate solution. And I thought, like, no, you can't say stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. But that's not what they mean.
No, no.
They don't mean courting racist whites against the interests of African Americans. They just
wink, wink.
They just mean courting homophobes. Instead. Yeah,
that's, well, there you go, actually. Indeed, because that's an interesting... It's also, I thought, I kind of liked what a just flat-out mercenary Jane appears to be, because when she finally decides they're just going to lose, she literally heads for the door. She's like, I quit.
I don't want you to quit.
I have a reputation to protect.
Quitter?
Better than loser.
It's just kind of any artifice about caring about what she's doing or fighting for something. She's just like, oh, we're going to do this and lose? See ya.
Yeah.
I got a reputation to protect. Just, that was just interesting character reveal.
I really like that character.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as much as she is painted to be a villain for us, I think Lawrence O'Donnell does such a great job with that character because she's not villainous and stupid.
For sure.
She's very smart about calling some of the angles and some of her harshness. I mean, it's the most painful voice to put some of these criticisms in, because she's right about the 50-state strategy, that's not something they can pursue now. But she's also speaking with a little level of like 2020 hindsight.
Yeah, which Bruno says at some point, we haven't talked about the 50-state solution in weeks. Like, give me a break.
Yeah.
She's just hammering him on something where she knows she's won.
Right.
He's conceded that already.
She gets to take this thing as an I told you so moment, even though there's no way for them, obviously, to have foreseen what could have happened in San Andreo.
Right.
And so Bruno, who has this wonderful grand plan, getting foiled by like an act of God, essentially, opens the door for Jane to be like, you're stupid.
Well, it's one of the things also in terms of Bruno's route through this episode that I kind of like about the briefcase subplot is that much as this thing fell in the lap of the campaign and absolutely pushed it off track, something else falls into their lap that maybe can just make it all okay again.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, you know, the one came whether they were prepared for it and there was nothing they could do about it. And the other thing, they have a moral decision to make. And there's a lot of Bruno in silence.
Yeah.
And just seeing his face and his expression. And I like that he's sort of grappling with something coming his way as out of the blue and as out of nowhere as the nuclear incident. I actually got goosebumps when he just said,
"You can make you president."
Yeah.
The import of that moment really hit me.
Yeah. I also don't want to go too far without talking about Vinnick's victory in San Andreo. I mean, we're talking right now about how they got derailed by this act of God, but he manages single-handedly to get it back on track.
Yeah, it's good to see Vinnick get his groove back.
Yeah.
That said, there is an element to that scene that made me laugh. There's an element of, what do they call it? Until they drop press conference?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if that's actually what they call it or if that term comes from this episode. But I've seen it referenced other times.
I have too, actually. Yeah.
But after this episode aired and in reference to this. So I don't know if it's funny. There's a little line that Toby gives Josh where he says,
"If this works,
work for Andrews in the Senate race. I got the tax thing behind him."
Like it's a well-known strategy that you could use every now and then, like the equivalent of like a campaign filibuster.
Well, that's what made me laugh. There's something, and I guess this is a slight criticism of the direction. There's something about the way Laura Innes has staged the scene that I think was unintentionally comical, which it plays out like a filibuster. Like the guy's been talking for 58 hours and there's shots of people like kind of like the journalist, the press corps is drooping, the cameraman wants to fall over, they're sweating. But I mean, I think what he was doing is just taking as many questions as they have. You know, I mean, I didn't get the feeling he was like, God, he's giving hour-long answers to every question.
Right.
So there's something about it, like it was almost like a scene out of an airplane movie for me where they're talking about like, it's so hot, you could fry an egg on the sidewalk. And then in the background, you see two men frying an egg on the sidewalk. Right. There's something so literal about it. Like, wow, they're literally dropping. Why didn't they just, you know, four questions earlier say, we don't have any more questions?
Yeah.
Like something about the physicality of it seemed a little bit silly.
The other thing that felt a little bit silly to me was the way that they pitted this press conference against Santos's own potential free media from his events in California. Because at a certain point, they're going to cut away. They're not going to show all 3 hours of his Till They Drop press conference.
No, it'll be on like some C-SPAN channel that nobody's watching, if anything, or not C-SPAN, it's not Congress, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Like, there's no way.
And yet you've got like Toby glued to the TV watching every, you know, every minute until he gets to the final solution until he gets to the final question. And, you know, we get a little bit of the thing of being told how to feel about the situation, you know, by getting Toby saying, damn, he's good. And Bruno saying, son of a bitch. And so it's not quite as much as like, hey, the episode's called 2 weeks out. It's 14 days till the election, but it is basically that.
Right.
So in case you missed it, he just turned this thing around. But it's nice that the briefcase comes in at this moment. You know, suddenly now they don't have to be quite so desperate. I think at the beginning of the episode, before they've dealt with San Andreo, that briefcase has a different kind of potential impact. But now I think everyone's talking about how great Vinnick has done. You know, he gets the applause from his own campaign when he walks in. And Toby says he's starting to sound like straight talking Arnie, the way that he, you know, the one that we have known. The one who, you know, Leo had described as being the kind of guy who is going to blow everybody away when he goes to campaign.
Yeah, well, Vinnick fights for it earlier in the episode. He basically says, I'm not even myself out there anymore. They are in this sort of panic, desperation mode, and he's just doing anything to try to stay afloat. And I liked seeing him back in this Vinnick mode where he can even admit fault, and he can say, in 26 years, you should improve, and I've got a new take, and I'm not blaming the president. And just, you get the best of Vinnick. There's something appealing about a candidate who's able to speak genuinely like that and actually admit to some fault. And it's, you could kind of see why taking on the issue really was a good idea for Vinnick, for a guy like Vinnick.
Yeah. And I love that we get to see Vinnick at his best, both in public, by the way he's handling the press conference, and in private, by the way he handles the descent from Jane. I think that conversation between the two of them is so fantastic. And you get the sense of like, what a great executive, what a great negotiator Vinnick can be, you know, when she is ready to leave. And he says,
if I win the election, you're going to get all the credit. You came onto a sinking ship and you saved the day.
If you lose?
Then you came onto a sinking ship and it sank. It's not your fault. How about we go with my strategy tomorrow and then we go with your strategy for the rest of the campaign?
He gives her all the reasons why she would be right not to quit that go above and beyond, it would be bad for us.
Right. This is just a brief little moment where Bruno is watching on TV and he says, Saint Santos. And that kind of made me laugh because I think Santos doesn't, it probably does mean saints. Or no, Santo is a little wooden carved depiction of a saint. So I just thought it was sort of maybe probably unintentional wordplay. Saint, saint.
That's pretty good.
The only other thing I had was Lou has some very hip tattoos.
Mm.
And we see them for the first time. It just, but it, even though it's just, you know, a visual moment, to me, it kind of opened up a whole other feeling about her character. Like, oh, okay, she's that person. And not a hip tattoo, but rather hip shoulder tattoos. I didn't get it. Yeah.
It's confusing that she has a tattoo of somebody's hip on her arm.
Right? That's weird. Weird yeah. choice. Yeah. But in a way, hip.
I really appreciated the way like Santos's plan got foiled. They were doing these kind of nimble maneuvers, trying to outflank Vinnick. And, you know, they have this strategic idea from Toby and the explanation of it, you know, makes sense and how they can turn things around and not spend as much money where it's going to be more expensive in California, only to have the thing fall out from under them because Vinnick wants to deal with what's happened in San Andreas, like for a completely different reason. Like Josh even says, well, if we do this and then they come after us, it's going to say, oh, Santos is being chased by Vinnick. You know, it's going to make Vinnick look bad.
Right.
And Jane says, has the same insight that this is going to look bad. I thought it was really clever and artfully done.
Agreed. Settle.
The reason why I ended my synopsis with a sports metaphor is just because it felt that way to me. I felt like I was watching a great football game or something like that. I felt like I was watching some great game, whatever the sport was, where it's just like really close and you never know what's going to happen. And you start to feel like one team is going to pull ahead only to have a sudden run by the other team bringing it back.
Yeah, I agree. The whole arc of this final season is exciting that way.
Yeah.
And tense and fun to watch. That wraps it up for another episode of the West Wing Weekly.
Thanks so much for listening. Thanks so much to Margaret Miller and Zach McNeese for helping us put together this episode. And thanks as well to Radiotopia from PRX. Radiotopia is the podcast network to which we belong. It is a collection of independent podcasts. And you should check out all the other shows, if you haven't yet, at radiotopia.fm.
That's right. You can follow us on Instagram, on Twitter, on Facebook, to the gates of hell. Just follow us blindly, please.
Okay.
Okay.
What's next?
Radiotopia.